Okay, welcome everybody. This is the fourth office hours session for the Mises Academy online class, Basics of Economics, Government Intervention. This week we covered drug prohibition, but as always in these classes, these office hour sessions, it's up to you guys what you want to talk about. Two things let me just throw out. So first is, if you're interested in that Thomas Piketty's book, I think that's how you say his name, Capital in the 21st Century, on the Tom Woods Show, which aired yesterday, so that would have been May 16th, 2014. If you go to the archives of his show and look that up, you can see Tom and I go through it. It's just an atrocious book. I mean, I'm beside myself. The more I read of it, the worse it got. But in the beginning, I was upset because it ignored some of the subtleties in capital and interest theory that are really the home court advantage of Austrian economists, because that's something that von Bavel really was a pioneer in. But you can kind of forgive that because a lot of economists, mainstream economists, don't know that stuff. Okay, fair enough. But then he was making just basic mistakes of historical fact, Piketty was, in his book. He's screwing up claims about what the top federal income tax rate was and when the minimum wage was increased. And moreover, it wasn't just mere sloppiness. His mistakes and or very misleading statements, so it was a combination. It wasn't just that he said things that were technically true, but the average reader would misunderstand. No, he said things that were just demonstrably false, saying federal tax rates were changed in this year when actually it was a different year, or saying the minimum wage was stable under this president's administration. Well, no, actually it went up under that guy's administration. But it wasn't just those explicit mistakes, but that they very conveniently served his narrative. And so you have to wonder, were they deliberate or not? I don't know the guy. And then beyond that, his proposals for massive worldwide government-coordinated sharing of financial information for the purposes of enacting confiscatory taxes, he admits, are not to raise money to spend on poor people, which you might just say, okay, yeah, he wants to take money from the super rich because he wants to do good with it. No, he explicitly says in his book the purpose of those tax rates is not to raise revenue, because he acknowledges when they're that high, people respond and don't work as much, or they don't build up fortunes that big if they know the government's going to take it. He said the purpose is to prevent the creation of such high incomes and fortunes in the first place. I mean, it's just monstrous. Okay, so anyway, that's, if you want to hear more about that, if you don't even know what I'm talking about, it's this book, Capital in the 21st Century, in April of 2014. It was all the rage. It was literally, for a period, the number one bestseller on Amazon. And I don't mean among nonfiction finance books. I'm saying flat out, you know, it was selling more than novels and, you know, self-help books. And, for example, Paul Krugman had a column called The Piketty Panic or something like that, or Panic Over Piketty. I don't remember the exact title, where he said, yeah, the right wing, it's been amusing to watch their reaction to this wonderful new book. The most they can do is call him names and say he's a Marxist. Well, yeah, if you ignore the documentation of all the theoretical and historical mistakes, that's all we do is call him names. Anyway, so that's on Tom's thing. One other point, by the way, for those of you who are tuned in here, by all means, be typing in your questions. You know, I realize you're sitting and listening on the edge of your seat to all of this wisdom pouring from my lips, but it helps me time what I'm doing if I see how many questions I got pending. So if you have something you want to ask, go ahead and type it in and I'll attend to your questions. But the other thing is, I wanted to point out, I didn't hit it in the lecture this week. We just ran out of time. It is in the textbook, but let me just elaborate on it. One of the points when it comes to crime and drug prohibition, I mean, it's a real simple point, but it's worth stating. A lot of the crime that flows from illegal drugs that people have in mind, that, oh, junkies out there in the street robbing old women or you know, somebody gets hooked and he starts stealing his parents' jewelry or, you know, mom's jewelry, or hawking things, the television set or whatever. And so that's a lot of socially conservative people who have not really studied the economics of the issue. That's why they're in favor of the war on drugs. It's because they're thinking, oh, wow, these are awful social trends, having people robbing others to support their drug addiction. And so that's amongst other reasons why I'm in favor of the government really cracking down on this, because we don't want people to get hooked on drugs and then go out and mug people and that sort of thing. Well, just think it through. If what you're concerned about is that there's a drug out there that's addictive and that, in fact, is so addictive that once somebody's hooked on it, he will do whatever it takes to get the money to buy his next fix. The last thing in the world you would want to do is make that drug 1,000 times more expensive. And yet that is what the drug war does. And in fact, even proponents of the drug war, serious, you know, policy analysts who have studied the matter and still will go to debates and things and argue for continuing the war on drugs, that's one of their chief points, is to say, look at how inaccessible we've made cocaine. It's very expensive. Now, if we didn't have this war on drugs, cocaine would be dirt cheap and heroin would be dirt cheap. And so they will point out that, look, we're greatly restricting the supply, and that makes it a lot more expensive, thinking people don't even try it in the first place. But again, the problem is, well, for those who do try it, particularly heroin, and then get hooked on it, well, now if it's a lot more expensive, that means you have to rob more people to get it. Whereas if it were a lot cheaper, that wouldn't solve the addiction problem by itself, but it would mean people wouldn't have to go around robbing people to pay for it. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I just wanted to, I didn't explicitly hit that point in the lecture, and just wanted to touch on that. Okay, for those of you tuned in live, do you have any burning issues? While you guys are brainstorming, what else can we talk about? Let me elaborate a little bit also on one of the points, but again, for those of you tuned in, I encourage you to type a question out. This issue of product purity, because that's the other thing. It's, you know, if a certain type of drug by its very nature is highly addictive, you're not going to be able to get away from that. Like cigarettes, for example, are legal, and that's reputed to be one of the hardest things to quit. Is if you're, you know, if you're a cigarette smoker and you're trying to quit, that's supposed to be really hard. Some people have said it's in the same league as trying to quit heroin. I have not been in those situations, so I don't know. Anyway, but the product purity, that's an issue that definitely would be better with legalization. And I touched on it a little bit in the lecture, but let me talk a little bit more about it right now. What you have is, what I want to talk about is this issue of from the seller's point of view or the producer's point of view, why is it that if there's prohibition in force, so that there's these stiff penalties that will be imposed on you if you get caught dealing this substance and you're not paying off the relevant government officials, why that would lead you in the new equilibrium to produce a product that is of higher potency. And so imagine, I don't remember who came up with this analogy, but it's perhaps a good one. Forget about alcohol or narcotics for the moment. Instead, just imagine shrimp, you know, like a shrimp cocktail or something. And the way, if you think about how that's sold at the store, it's not that you just take a bunch of shrimp, regardless of the size, you put it on a scale, and then it's, you know, certain dollars per pound if you're in the United States. Right? That's not how they sell it. There's distinctions, and jumbo shrimp is more expensive. Okay, so if you have a big shrimp that weighs as much as like three smaller ones, typically the way that's sold in the store, it's not that you would pay the same dollar amount for that one big shrimp as you would pay for the three little ones put together, even if they weigh the same amount. Instead, you would pay a higher unit price for that big one because people would rather eat the big honking shrimp than the little ones. Okay, so imagine now that the government comes along and imposes a big penalty on shrimp and says, if we catch you selling shrimp to people, we're gonna give you a 1 year prison sentence. Well, that wouldn't completely eliminate the practice. That would probably, you would probably still would be able to get shrimp on the black market. But the point is, do you think the proportion of jumbo shrimp to regular shrimp would be unaffected? And probably it would be affected. You would probably see in the new equilibrium that in the black market, more jumbo shrimp gets sold as a proportion of the total amount compared to the regular size ones than it was originally when it was unregulated. And the reason is that, just think through the logistics of it, if you're going to go to the trouble of surreptitiously, you know, making deals with shrimp farmers to get this stuff and then sneak it around in coolers or whatever and have it out of the back of your truck or do whatever you're doing, sell it out of your basement or on a street corner, then that's a risky operation. And so you're only going to be able to have limited quantities of it. You're not going to have it in a big case at a grocery store because it's illegal. You're not going to have it in plain sight as an institutionalized thing. It's got to be real mobile and you got to sneak around and do it because it's the black market. So if you're going to do that, if you're going to stock, let's say, a cooler with some ice and put shrimp on it so that you can sell it to people on a street corner or whatever you're doing, you're not going to fill it with the little dinky shrimp. You're going to fill that cooler up with the very potent jumbo shrimp because other things equal, you can charge a higher price per pound. So it's true, under prohibition, the price per pound of shrimp's going to go up across the board. But if people always are willing to pay more for jumbo shrimp than for the regular shrimp, the point is that you're still going to get the highest price per pound if you're selling jumbo shrimp. And so since you have these like fixed costs, not in dollar terms, but in terms of the risk of being arrested and going to prison, what you're probably going to end up doing is just focusing on concentrating on selling the jumbo shrimp to the people who want to pay for it. All right, so if you kind of understand it in that context, the principle generalizes that I talked about alcohol during the lecture. If you were a merchant who, when alcohol is legal, offers a wide spectrum of products, ranging from hard liquor down to wine coolers, and now the government comes in and says, if we catch you selling alcohol, you're going to prison, well, you might end up still supplying it on the black market, but now you're going to probably focus just on the hard liquor because there you can get a lot more revenue per fluid ounce than you can if you're selling wine coolers. Okay. There's also cultural factors that go along with it that if, you know, the from your customer's point of view, if you're the sort of person before when it was legal and maybe you were someone like a, you know, young woman who just drank wine coolers, well, now if it's illegal and you're going to these underground parties and everybody there is breaking the law, all kind of in on the joke and, you know, oh, we're cool, we're, you know, we're rebels, we're breaking the law. And while this whoever is running this speakeasy, he's a cool guy, he's willing to do something even though if the cops come in, we could all get arrested. This is amazing. Well, if you're in that, if you're running those circles, you're probably not going to just keep drinking wine coolers, right? Because you're going to feel like a lightweight. Right, you're probably over time going to end up developing a taste for, an appetite for the harder stuff, either because that's all that's available or just because now you're associating with a different crowd, right? Because the type of crowd you would be in drinking with when it's legal is going to be more of a cross-section of the population, whereas when it's illegal, if you still end up choosing to drink on the weekend, the crowd you're doing it with, that's not a cross-section of society. That's specifically the people who don't mind breaking the law openly. And so that's a different kind of people. And like I said, just hanging around them year after year, depending on how long the prohibition's in force, that's going to change your preferences. And you're going to end up probably drinking harder stuff than you would have had it remained legal. Okay. Don says, I'm currently reading The Great Deformation by David Stockman. He seems sympathetic to the Austrian point of view, but there are other issues in which he seems to disagree, like the importance of trade deficits. What do you think of his book? Okay, great question. Let me say, I hope this is appropriate for me to mention, but I can't neglect to mention it since you just lobbed me a softball there, Don. Every year, my business partner and I have an event in Nashville, where I live, called the Night of Clarity. So this year, it's August 15th and 16th, which is a Friday and Saturday in the year's 2014, if people are hearing this recording. And so if you go to nightofclarity.com to see the details, David Stockman is actually our headline speaker this year. So that's why I'm hijacking your question in order to shamelessly plug our event. So anyway, I'll drop it now. I don't want to turn this into a commercial, but if you go to nightofclarity.com and you're curious, you can see the details there about David Stockman coming and headlining our event in Nashville. Don, yeah, I have read his book. And I mean, I didn't read it cover to cover, but I certainly read large sections of it. And can you remind me of what he said specifically on trade deficits? I mean, I could talk a lot about the Austrian view of trade deficits, and I thought I knew what Stockman's position was, but I'm curious. Are you saying, Don, that the Austrians say trade deficits aren't a big deal and Stockman says they are? Because can you confirm that for me, Don, or clarify, and then I can go off. Okay, yes. All right. So it's the same thing with Peter Schiff. Okay. So let me clarify all this stuff for newcomers. The biggest mistake professionally I made, I've certainly made worse mistakes in my private life, but the biggest mistake professionally I made is when I first encountered Peter Schiff's writings back in, I guess, 2006, I thought he was a Cassandra. I thought he was just being real melodramatic and over-the-top warnings, and I did not at that time understand the ticking time bomb on which the U.S. economy was sitting. Fortunately, I realized my mistake and sort of did a mea culpa before things blew up. So it was specifically in July of 2007 when a bank client contracted with me to do a forecast of interest rates and other trends. That's when I realized, holy cow, you know, we really are on the verge of a crash. And so I apologized publicly to Schiff and then privately sent him an email and so on and said, yeah, sorry, I was wrong. But let me, so again, I was on the record saying, yep, we're in store for a big crash more than a year before it happened. So, at least I got it right before it blew up. But let me explain to you guys why I initially was so skeptical of Schiff's claim. And Don, don't worry, this is directly relevant to what you're asking. Because if you read a lot of the stuff that I had been seeing from Schiff, in 2006 and early 2007, he was a lot of it. And of course, you know, talking about short little blog posts or op-eds he was pumping out. And so I wasn't realizing his full theoretical worldview. I was just seeing little snippets. And so from my limited window into how he was thinking, it looked like he was saying, if a country is running trade deficits, that's prima facie bad. And the longer a country runs trade deficits, that means the more unstable it's getting, and that eventually it's going to blow up or crash. And that, you know, a healthy economy needs to be running trade surpluses or at least a roughly balanced trade account. And so the fact that there's these chronic trade deficits that the U.S. is running shouldn't wake us all up to the fact that something unsustainable is going on. Okay. And so that, I'm dumbing it down a little bit, but that was kind of the message that I was seeing from Schiff in 2006 and early 2007. And strictly speaking, that's not correct. Okay, now what happened is later when I realized how bad things were, I was realizing, yeah, it depends why the trade deficits are so big. And so Schiff was, I mean, obviously he was correct when he was saying a crash is coming and housing is overvalued and there's big bubbles. And what the Bush administration and the Bernanke or the Greenspan Fed have been doing is awful. That obviously is all, he was correct in all that. But specifically to be making what at the time seemed like blanket statements about chronic trade deficits are a sign that something is seriously amok. Again, strictly speaking, that's not correct economically. And so that's what, and so I was hammering him, and then I went too far. I wasn't just saying at the time, oh, he's making a theoretical mistake here, or he's not stating his position properly. Let me offer a more refined general theoretical view, of which our current condition is a special case where, yeah, he is right. It's a sign of danger. I wish I had said that, but I didn't. At the time, I didn't realize the full danger. Okay. So now, especially with the benefit of hindsight, I think the way we can understand Peter Schiff and then David Stockman, who are pointing to U.S. trade deficits that really started mushrooming in the 1980s. And then let me post you guys a link here, because I literally just wrote about this on Friday, so it's kind of fortuitous. So it's the Liberty Chat. It's for the site libertychat.com. Let me see if I can. Okay. Yeah. So I'm gonna post the link here for you guys who are tuned in and who can see the chat box. But it's at libertychat.com, and it was on May 16, 2014. And the opening is "Still No Crash." It's an article that I wrote. So here, let me go ahead and post this. The thing. Okay, but did that show? Okay, yeah, shut up. So anyway, let me just, for those of you who are tuned in listening to this or hearing the recording, let me just walk you through some of the main points. The U.S., well, okay, first of all, one issue is, it's actually the correct thing is not to talk about the trade deficit or the trade surplus. The actual, the better category is what's called the current account, either deficit or surplus. Because what's happening is, think of it in terms of a household, first of all. Normally you would think, oh, for the household to be treading water, you would need to have your exports, your sales, the work you do and sell to outsiders equal the amount of stuff you buy from outsiders. So you would want your wages to equal your consumption or your purchases. Right? You might think that that's what the household needs to do to be treading water, and that if your work or your wages are higher than your spending, well, then your assets are growing and you're getting wealthier. That would be like a trade surplus, okay? But actually, if you think it through, that's not what you need. That's a stronger condition. All you really need to have so that you're not getting poorer over time is that your income is higher, or at least as high as your consumption in your investment expenditures too, if you want to get real technical about it. All right, your spending, let's call it. Right, so as long as your income is higher than your spending, then you're fine in terms of the individual household, right? You know you're not getting poorer over time. Your wealth is not decreasing. And you might say, yeah, isn't that what you just said? Well, no, because you can earn income without working. If you have a bunch of stocks or bonds or some real estate, you know, financial assets, they can generate an income. And so even if you don't work at all and your wages are zero, you could still be consuming. You could use the income generated by your stocks and bonds and what have you, and then use that to go buy your groceries, pay your rent if you're renting an apartment, pay for your electricity, and so on. Okay. Or if you are working, then of course you add the two together. And so you can, so strictly speaking, it's not that your output, you know, the work that you do, the things you produce, have to have the same market value as the things that you buy for your household. Rather, it's your total income has to be high enough to cover that. Okay, so it's a comparable thing with the nation, the way they do these trade accounts, or I should say international accounts. It's not that, strictly speaking, the U.S. does not need to export goods and services that have the same market value as the goods and services they import, because the U.S. owns a bunch of financial assets abroad. And so really the issue is U.S. exports plus their earnings on international assets, is that higher or lower than U.S. imports plus the earnings of foreigners on U.S. assets? That's really the issue. Okay, and so that broader thing is called the current account. So that has to do with income broadly defined, not just looking at income from exports. Okay, so anyway, back to the main point. If you look at those accounts, the U.S. current account was roughly in balance throughout the gold standard era. I mean, it would deviate year to year, but it wasn't like there was this system-wide discrepancy one way or the other, at least, let's say, from World War I on, okay? But starting around in the early 1980s, it really goes in deficit. And then it came back close to breaking even with the recession of – which recession was that? I think it was in the recession in the early 90s, and then it just blows up even more during the Clinton administration. It comes back a little bit during the dot-com crash, and then it just explodes again under the George W. Bush administration, okay, in terms of deficits. And so that's certainly what Peter Schiff was looking at, and I think what David Stockman's looking at. And so one of the ways to understand that is to say, well, wait a minute, the U.S. went off the gold standard in 71, and so maybe and by the way, the current account deficit did start increasing in 71, but my point is it didn't really just blow up until the 80s. And so a lot of people are saying those two things are intimately related, but if you think about it, when a country's on a gold standard, the trade accounts can't get too out of whack, because ultimately, if one country is – I'm going to switch back to just terms of exports and imports, because that's easier to picture in your head. If one country is exporting more stuff than it's importing, so running a trade surplus, well, what does that mean? That other country must be sending gold over if we're on a strict gold standard, okay? Whether it's literally shipping the gold or just the gold in their vaults, is more and more of it is being earmarked as the property of the people who live across the ocean. That's just the physical location of gold is not a big deal. But in terms of who owns it, okay. So ultimately, that's what happens when there's a gold standard, is that the discrepancies in exports and imports are ultimately settled up with gold, and so. As with Hume's price specie flow mechanism, which we talked about on the lecture 3, if the people in one country have their gold piling up, well, that's going to cause prices to rise in their country, and the country with the gold being drained from, well, that's going to cause prices to fall. And so ultimately, you would think the net trade balance would go the other way, that eventually the country with the high prices would start importing goods because they were cheaper to get them abroad. And similarly, the people where the goods are really cheap, they would stop importing from the expensive country. And so you'd see the trade balance flow the other way. All right, so that's the mechanism by which you would think large trade imbalances, when all the countries are on a strict classical gold standard, would be self-reversing. And then you wouldn't expect to have a systematic thing decades after decades of massive trade imbalances, at least other things equal. Okay, so So you can see why, oh, so then once the U.S. went off the gold standard, maybe that's partly what's going on. And specifically what's happening is that, because here's what's going on. As the U.S. is printing up more dollar bills, if the rest of the world is just holding dollars as the reserve currency rather than gold, well, so long as they're willing to enlarge their holdings of it, of dollar assets, it's a good deal for the U.S. They can, you just think about it, they can basically take a green piece of paper, cut it into a rectangle, stamp $100 and put Ben Franklin's face on it, send it to people in China, who then add it to their cash balances, and the people in China send Americans a television set that has a market value of $100. So that's a pretty good deal. If you think about it, it's like a major U.S. export is dollar bills instead of, you know, software or wheat or something that takes a lot of resources and know-how to produce. That, oh, one of our exports is these green pieces of paper that people around the world are using for their money. So it's sort of like back in the days of the classical gold standard, if there was a small country somewhere that just happened to be blessed with gold deposits, if you looked at the trade accounts, they would be running massive trade deficits. But that's fine because they would be bringing gold to the surface. You know, maybe they have a mint or something on their island. And they stamp it into coins, and they send the coins abroad. And then people send them all sorts of goodies, crude oil, cars, computers, whatever, stakes. And that's, you know, they could keep doing that forever because they literally produce gold. They're supplying the world money if the world used gold coins. So by the same reasoning, if the whole world is using U.S. dollars as their money or as a reserve currency, then the U.S. government can get away printing up dollars and sending them abroad and getting stuff. Okay, so that's very loosely and intuitively what one way of interpreting what has happened since then, since the U.S. totally severed the tie between the dollar and gold. And so that the reason that couldn't get too out of hand before, because you might say, well, wait a minute, I thought under the Bretton Woods system, the U.S. dollar was the world's reserve currency. That, you know, in the post-World War II era, the dollar was clearly king. But the way they got the other countries to go along with that at the Bretton Woods Conference was that they said, don't worry, the dollar is as good as gold because you central bankers can turn in dollars and we will redeem them with physical gold at the ratio of $35 to an ounce of gold. And so ultimately, if central banks around the world started accumulating too many dollars, they would just send them back to Uncle Sam, they send us some gold. And so that limited the monetary inflation on the U.S. government's part because they knew there was that ultimate check. And so that's once that check was gone, though, they could inflate with relative abandon, only constrained by price inflation domestically and you know, if their trading partners around the world start saying, don't you think you guys maybe ought to ease up a little bit because we're sitting on a bunch of dollar-denominated assets here. We don't want you to crash the dollar. Okay, so Don, that's where I think Schiff and Stockman are coming from. And then let me now very quickly explain the broader theoretical perspective to say, strictly speaking, I'm sorry, guys, let me just round out that discussion. So if you've bought what I've said so far, notice that's like a ticking time bomb because the rest of the world is accumulating dollar savings or holdings. And with this stuff too, it's not literally just green pieces of paper, even though it is. People do around the world use green pieces of paper, especially in countries where their own currency is very volatile, that they might literally hold U.S. dollar bills in their wallet or, you know, in a safe in their house as a store of value because they can't trust their government to not debase their own currency. But more generally, central banks and other financial institutions around the world might have large holdings of dollar-denominated assets that aren't literally dollars. So they might have U.S. Treasury bonds, okay, IOUs issued by the U.S. federal government. So what is that? It is a financial asset that entitles you to payment of future flows of U.S. dollars. Okay, so it's not literally that you're holding dollars, but you're holding an asset that is denominated in dollars. But what that then gives you a legal right to is a stream of dollar payments over time. Okay, so there's plenty of people around the world accumulating an ever-growing stockpile of this stuff, and for which they have sent people in the U.S. goodies. So that was a good deal while it lasted, but the point is that that ever flips, and all of a sudden people around the world lose confidence in the dollar. What's going to happen? They're going to – how do they get rid of their dollar holdings? You know, so in other words, what if everyone around the world gradually over the next few years says, you know, we've been watching this situation, and it looks like whenever the U.S. stock market starts to falter, whoever's in charge of the Fed – it used to be Bernanke, now it's the Yellen lady – they just go out and create $500 billion more dollars and throw it at assets to push up stock prices. And so, you know what? I don't really feel comfortable holding a bunch of U.S. treasuries that are entitling me to a flow of dollar bills when that's their policy. That these dollar bills 5 years from now that I'm getting from holding all of these treasuries are not going to buy as much in the marketplace as I think right now because they're really debasing the dollar. So what are you going to do? You're going to start selling that stock to get rid of it before it crashes. And so if more and more people start doing that, ultimately what does that mean? It means, first of all, U.S. interest rates rise, right? Because if you're holding treasuries and you try to sell them, well, bond prices and interest rates move inversely. So that means the yield on treasuries is going to go up if treasury holders around the world are trying to dump them to get rid of them. I mean, because their price goes down, you know, they're just trying to have a fire sale. And so somebody who gets in and buys at the low price now gets a higher rate of return on his or her purchase. And so the yield to maturity goes way up. Okay, so that's how it works on the asset side. But in terms of U.S. citizens, it means all of a sudden interest rates here are going to zoom up if people start dumping treasuries. And then the cost of financing the national debt is going to go way up and so on. Right? The cost of the U.S. government to borrow money will just all of a sudden be a lot more. And then if people around the world don't want to be holding actual dollar bills, what are they going to do with it? Well, ultimately they're going to flow back to the United States. It's going to be the opposite of how they ended up holding the dollar bills in the first place. They're going to say, I don't want to be holding hundreds of dollars of green pieces of paper when I don't know what the purchasing power this is going to be 2 years from now, so I want to get rid of this. And if they can't find anyone in their country who wants to hold it, ultimately it will find its way back to the U.S. It will find its way back into the hands of people who use dollars day to day as money. And so why would they do? They're not just going to give it to us for free. They're going to say, give me something for it. And so ultimately the dollar bills will flow back into the United States, and real goods and services will flow out of the United States to those foreigners. So that will juice the export numbers. And incidentally, that's why people like Paul Krugman and Dean Baker, if you know that guy, they want the dollar to fall against other currencies because they're saying, oh, that would boost exports and create jobs at home. All right. So they are agreeing with the mechanism I'm describing, but they're thinking that's a good thing. Because they're saying, oh, that will mean foreigners will boost their aggregate demand for U.S. goods. When I'm saying, okay, but another way of accurately describing it is all these dollars around the world are going to flow back to the U.S., driving up prices here. And again, the Keynesians would say, yeah, that's the point. We want there to be price inflation. But Austrians think that could be pretty devastating, right, if all of these billions or – I don't know what the number's up top of my head. It might be more than a trillion, but I'm not sure, of actual green pieces of paper held around the world. And it's also in terms of bank accounts, too, checking account balances. And there it's hard to figure out where they are located, where the owners are located. Okay, so if you're talking about regular households in some Latin American country where they're worried about the government debasing the currency, they might literally be holding $20 bills, you know, hidden in their, under their mattress or something, just as a safety mechanism. But if you're talking about financial institutions like foreign businesses, they might have a bank account with Citigroup and have $500,000 in a few different checking accounts. And they don't even need to have it literally physically located in their country. They could just have an account with Citigroup that's located, you know, domiciled in the United States or something. And it would be hard. You can't just look at the Federal Reserve's big reports, the aggregate numbers, and figure out, okay, of all the checking account deposits in U.S. commercial banks, which ones are owned by U.S. citizens and which ones are actually owned by foreigners who just want to diversify their holdings and have some actual U.S. currency. You wouldn't be able to break that out, at least not at the top level reports. And so it's all those too. So when you say, you know, geez, how many dollars are you talking about if the whole world literally lost confidence and just wanted to dump the dollar? It's hard to say, but it's a big number. And so from the perspective of Americans walking around minding their own business, it would be as if all of a sudden $1 trillion, let's say, all of a sudden just appears and rushes in, and people are trying to buy goods and services with an extra $1 trillion. And it's not Americans, it's foreigners coming in. And so if you think that just if Yellen created $1 trillion and just handed it out to random foreign people, and then you think through the consequences of what would happen if they then tried to spend it, well, from the perspective of Americans, they would see prices of everything go up, and they wouldn't be the ones buying it. It would be the foreigners who had this extra purchasing power. All right, so that's the kind of scenario this would lead to. So, Don, you can see where Stockman and Schiff are coming from, saying this is a very bad situation. These chronic current account deficits over the last few decades have put us in a very precarious position, and that's why we need to enact policies that show the rest of the world that our government is serious about fiscal constraint, that we're going to start running budget surpluses, that we're going to get our house in order, because we do not want foreign investors and central banks to doubt the integrity of the dollar, because if they do, it could flip overnight. It could just crash, and there could be a run on the dollar. Right, that's the idea. Okay, I kind of beat that to death. Now, very quickly, what's the more general theoretical perspective? In general, free market economists, and Austrians in particular, are not afraid of trade deficits. In fact, many free market economists don't even like that term, because they think it's a loaded term to say, you know, that it's a bad thing because the deficit's bad. And for all the reasons I went through in the lecture on free trade that I gave to you guys, if we're a given household, for example, to say they had a trade deficit with the state of Florida, that's stupid. Who cares? Or even to say that a given household has a trade deficit with the rest of the world, who cares? As I pointed out, you could, first of all, have a current account surplus and trade deficit. Right, maybe you're not working very much, but you have all these financial assets that are generating an income. Or even if you have a current account deficit as a household with the rest of the world, again, that is not necessarily a bad thing. You could be a retired person, and you start out with $5 million in your 401k and other investments, and you take cruises and stuff, and you're not working, you're not producing anything, but you're drawing down your wealth, your assets, your estate value, and you live like a king for 25 years, and then you die, and you still have $2 million left for your heirs. And so from the time of your retirement to the time you died, maybe you were consuming more than your income, but so what? You planned on doing that. It's not a big deal. That's optimal. Okay, so that's the kind of thing that you wonder, okay, well, then what's the analog for a country? It gets trickier, but still, I mentioned this last time, if you had a small group of people who implemented anarcho-capitalism, the trade accounts would probably show that that region ran massive trade deficits or even current account deficits indefinitely. because investors around the world would be itching to get a piece of the assets, the financial assets being generated by this place. And so over time, you know, the real estate on the, let's say it was a little island somewhere, as people realized, holy cow, this place is unbelievably productive because they don't have government rules and stuff. It's just all free market stuff. It'd be kind of like if a worker from anywhere around the world goes to this place, all of a sudden he's 100 times more productive. So it would almost be like a magical place that instantly multiplies the productivity of physical things by 100. It wouldn't really be doing that. Rather, it's just showing you anyone operating elsewhere under the state has their productivity greatly diminished. But from the perspective of the normal people walking around Earth who don't really understand economics, this little island that had Rothbardian institutions would seem magical. And so what do you want to do? I want to get a piece of that. Let me buy some stock in the companies in this place. Let me buy an acre of farmland in this place. Let me buy an acre of real estate where they're going to put an apartment complex or a shopping mall. And so you would see over time the price of an acre of farmland or something in this place just go through the roof. And so they could, the way that would play out is over time, they could just sell little bits of it to the foreigners in exchange for them sending in all sorts of crude oil and steel and all the other raw materials that the people on the little Rothbardian Island would need in order to build their skyscrapers and their satellites that have laser defenses to keep governments away and, you know, all that kind of stuff. All right. So the point is, Peter Schiff, you know, that type of analysis. Now, probably in practice, Peter Schiff would look at that and say, oh, okay, that's productive. I'm not saying he would fall for it and make a mistake, but I'm saying the specific argument in his quick 750-word blog post or op-ed from 2006, using that same argument, looking at that Rothbardian paradise, would conclude erroneously, oh my gosh, that place was one massive trade deficits that were like 30% of GDP for the last 10 years. That's going to blow up any second now. When, no, that would be a sign of the immense wealth of this place. Okay, last thing to see this, the current account deficit is necessarily the mirror image of the capital account surplus. Okay, so if you are consuming more than your income, if you're spending more than your income on goods and services, then necessarily that means the rest of the world must be on net acquiring financial assets in you. And so the sinister way to look at that is to say, or the scary way to look at that is to say, oh, you're borrowing money from people to finance your overconsumption. You're living beyond your means, and so you're floating IOUs, and so outsiders are gaining more of a claim on your future earnings. So, but the trade account's still balanced. Your current account deficit is mirrored by the capital account surplus of everybody else. Their ownership of capital assets on you is growing more than your ownership of you, than your claims on them. And that sounds bad, and it is unsustainable. On the other hand, if you form a new corporation and you go public, or you split the stocks and you bring in more investment, well, it's the same thing, right? The rest of the world is now gaining more financial ownership of your entity. And what are you going to do with, you know, investors pump in another $10 million because you issued more shares of stock? Well, you're going to use it to go maybe build a new factory. Okay, so just think through that. Maybe that means you're in a Rothbardian paradise, that maybe it's easier for you guys to picture it. Imagine a company that wants to expand, and what do? They say, well, let's just issue more shares of stock. And so they do that, and they bring in $10 million of investment, and then they use it to go buy it to build a factory. Okay, well, in terms of if you apply the international trade account to that entity, they would have run a massive current account deficit, and there would have been a massive trade deficit. Outsiders would have gained $10 million more of ownership claims on that entity in exchange for $10 million worth of steel and construction crew services and other goods and services coming into the company which they use to build a factory. All right, so that's certainly not a sign of, uh-oh, this is unsustainable, because they're doing it to expand their productive capacity in the future. And so long as they made a good investment, their earnings are going to grow such that it's fine, and that the original owners are still going to get the same flow of dividends or even more, even though there's now other investors who own part of the company. Okay. And I did like his book, Don. Incidentally, Don, I reviewed Stockman's book for Barron's, if you want to try to Google it. I don't know if you're going to be able to find it. I think you can. I think it is available online, even if you're not a subscriber. Okay, Raja says, why do you continue to live in the U.S. when the future looks so dangerous? Okay, that's a good question. Okay, one obvious reason is I have a young son, and so it's not just my decision, you know, that there's family ties and things like that. And so certainly I'm going to be wherever he is. The other thing is my situation. If I were 21 right now, maybe I would seriously consider, you know, if I were 21 and totally unattached and just with no family ties and such, I probably would consider going somewhere else. But given where I am and the things I've got going on, I think I'm going to remain here. But that's not because I'm thinking, oh, no, it'll turn around. I have a very pessimistic outlook. I think the U.S. is devolving into a literal police state. Part of the explanation is I think that's true of many other places as well. So it's if there were some, you know, that Rothbardian island that I was talking about that was totally free in the libertarian sense of the word and had strong institutions and could mount an adequate military defense and I thought they wouldn't get invaded and that kind of thing, yeah, maybe I would really consider moving there, even if it just meant I was flipping hamburgers, but I was living in a politically free environment. But I don't really see such a place. You know, that any major Western country is basically like the U.S. And other places I've seen people point out, it's kind of like, yeah, you can go there and just lay low and be hidden. But that's, you know, I don't want to be scurrying around like a rat. I kind of would rather just, you know, take the stand and be documenting this descent into the police state. And if 10 years from now I'm in a FEMA camp, so be it. So and I'm not saying that flippantly. I'm not saying it because I think, oh, that's not really going to happen. I'm saying it frankly that, yeah, I don't, I mean, I'm religious. I don't know if that helps influence or if it helps you understand where I'm coming from. So it's not that in my mind, oh, you've got this one life here on earth and you better do what you can, and then after that, there's nothing. To me, it's, you know, I would rather live according to certain principles here, and if that means that some of those years are spent behind bars or whatever, okay, maybe that's what I'm supposed to do. Okay, looks like the last question we'll answer today says, from a free market perspective, does it make a difference if the country with lots of public industries, one, sells them, two, gives them out for free, or three, some combination in between? If there are no barriers to trade, isn't that a good thing for the country? Okay, and by public industries, you mean government-owned, and we're talking about how to privatize them, how to get them into the hands of the private sector? I've done some sort of back of the envelope calculations for a few different outlets where I show, for example, every time the Republicans and the Democrats fight over raising the budget, or sorry, the debt ceiling, if for foreign students, just to explain, so the way the U.S. government works right now, Congress has to periodically raise the statutory limit of the total amount of outstanding debt that the U.S. Treasury can legally issue. Okay, so it's kind of an odd system because it's Congress ultimately that passes the appropriations and taxation measures that the president can then either veto or sign. And so ultimately, if the Treasury is running budget deficits and having to issue bonds to cover its spending in excess of tax receipts, that's because it's spending money that Congress presumably has already authorized. So it's a bit weird where Congress is giving the Treasury the ability to borrow money to pay for the stuff that Congress says you got to spend it, you know, pay for. But be that as it may, that's the situation, that's the system, and there's some reasons that I think actually it makes sense. But in any event, anytime they have these fights, the people who say, oh no, Congress has to raise the debt ceiling because otherwise we're going to have to cut all these programs and it's going to be this huge dislocation. It's really unrealistic to demand that the government balances its budget immediately. And so that's why they need to raise the debt ceiling to give us more breathing room while we ultimately get our finances in order. I will just list a few bullet points and just show there are tons of assets that the federal government owns that it could sell off in order to raise revenue to fund that transition period. So in other words, they wouldn't need to raise taxes and they wouldn't need to cut spending to literally balance the budget immediately if their objective is to not issue more debt. Because the way they could buy themselves a few years of breathing room where spending is still in excess of tax receipts is by selling off a bunch of these assets, and that's the way they can bring in extra money without taxing people. Okay, so it's what is clearly absurd is for the federal government to remain the owner of all of these things, and it's like easily over $1 trillion worth of stuff. I mean, the U.S. is the largest landholder by U.S. government is the largest landholder by far. In terms of, you know, Western states looking at the map and what does the federal government own compared to people in the private sector. The U.S. government owns the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, which is a bunch of crude oil that's stockpiled. It claims that it owns a bunch of gold. You know, there's all sorts of things. It owns all sorts of office buildings that it doesn't even use. There's all kinds of stuff the government could sell off. All right, so in that respect, it's politically very convenient, Raha, to say, to add that stuff up and to make the argument that, well, geez, you know, if you guys are wondering where the money's going to come, instead of raising taxes, how about the government sells off these things? Okay, there's also the issue of if you are going to take a resource and give it to someone in the private sector, you should have an auction and give it to the person who's willing to bid the most, because presumably that person is going to have the best use for it. Okay, and just like in general, that's what market prices do in general. If someone's going to sell something and they sell it to the higher bidder, that's a good thing. That allocates resources to those ends where they're most highly desired. Okay, the problem, though, is in practice, there's a moral issue and then like an efficiency argument. And let me just make these two points and then I'll wrap it up for you guys. So the moral argument is, If you're a Rothbardian, it's not that the government is the just owner of all this stuff. And so why should the government be able to auction it off and get the high, you know, they should just give it out somehow. Maybe, you know, if it's an industry, just like factories, give it to the workers or something. That by the government auctioning it off to the highest bidder, that makes it look like the government is a legitimate owner that has the right to those receipts. So that's one issue. And then the other issue is it just opens up a window for a lot of corruption, specifically if you're talking about like the way the former Soviet Union, when it privatized a lot of its stuff, it was really shady backroom deals where they ended up transferring a lot of these assets. It wasn't like a fair and open bidding process. They ended up like giving it in the hands of former KGB officials and things. Okay, so it was not, because remember, it's the government does not actually have the motivation to auction off resources to the highest bidder, because the government officials involved don't get to keep the money. And so instead, what they have the incentive to do is to have a rigged auction process and then give it to their cronies, who are then going to reward them when they're out of office or in some other way behind the scenes. Okay, so I think that's partly why Rothbard, for example, was real skeptical about this kind of stuff. And he was saying, you know, the important thing is just really quickly, if people are talking about privatization, just boom, get it into the hands of the public. I don't care who, really. Get it into the hands of people in the private sector quickly. And I don't even want there to be compensation. We, you know, first of all, the government has no right to that money. And also, they're going to corrupt it anyway. It's not going to be used to offset taxes or something. They're going to use it for nefarious ends anyway and fund with the evil people. So just transfer it and get it in the hands of the private sector. And don't worry, you know, once it's in genuinely private hands, the resources will quickly find their way into where the most useful end is. So in other words, even if you just give it to people, give a factory to the workers, and actually that's not really an efficient organization, well, some outside capitalists will come along and make a deal with the workers and buy them out. That, you know, it will be a win-win situation, and so you don't have to worry about something being perpetually in an inefficient operation because the government didn't privatize it properly. Rothbard's saying, no, the real danger is leaving it in government hands. Get it into the hands of private owners, and it will quickly find its way into the most productive outlet. Okay, I will stop there. Thanks, guys, for tuning in, and we'll see you next week for the second last lecture.